us and we're talking about art, especially I want to focus on young people that get isolated and get stigmatized, and then they start to break down mentally, and how the arts might be able to help them.
One of the things we're doing in our lab right now is a youth mental health project, and it's very focused on youth voice. And we're learning that youth don't like the term mental health, and they don't even really like the word well-being. And I think what we're finding is that youth have been left out of the conversation. People talk about them, not with them. And so we're learning a lot about the ways that they share their voices, and that when they're not able to share their voices, or when other people tell them what they think, there's a lot of frustration and anger that sometimes gets built up, and resentment. And we do know that when you share your voice, you are able to unstick some of that or just process that. So there's a emeritus professor, University of Texas, Austin, named James Pennebaker, who's done some beautiful work on expressive writing. And what he has found, that when people express themselves in writing, it doesn't have to be beautiful, don't need to be a writer, but when you express your voice, you lower cortisol, which is the stress hormone, so you manage your stress, and you also offer the opportunity to expand your cognitive load. So as you think and think and overthink and are upset, you lower your cognitive load. So you have less capacity to make good decisions and to think. We all experience that normally throughout the day, right? Unless you take breaks and you take naps. Naps, the greatest thing in the world. You have lower cognitive load, but expressive writing allows you to kind of sort of empty out some of that to give you more thinking. And you know, when we're not exhausted, we make better decisions. The other thing we've seen in work by epidemiologist Daisy Fancourt is that youth who are engaged in art make better decisions, stay in school longer, get better grades, delay having early pregnancies, and in general have a more positive outlook on life.
I just think about education and how they're cutting the arts programs right and left. And it sounds like what both you, Susan, and Ivy are saying is that these really are fundamental to who we are. And it's fundamental that we actually encourage young people to express themselves in the arts. And that's one of the best ways that we can help them.
Absolutely. And it's not just getting an art teacher in every classroom. It's that mindset throughout the learning, journey. So it's beyond just an art class. But Susan and I spoke at the Getty Museum to 500 school superintendents, because in California, they have voted to make sure that there's an art teacher in every classroom. And so, we begged them, don't blow this, because it's an incredible model for the rest of the country. I just want to go back to even younger children, because I think it starts in infant and toddler age. I worked with Dr. Stuart Brown at the National Institute for Play, and he studied some of these kid killers that we didn't have in the 50s. We didn't have kids that came into school and would destroy people's lives. And this idea of free play, and our brains are wired to make these connections as kids, which is that idea of taking a cardboard box, and it could be a TV set, a tent. You explore it creatively as to what it could be, which is free play, which the definition of play is doing something without a preconceived outcome. And so you're discovering things, and you're discovering that there is not one way, but five different ways, let's say, to use this cardboard box. Well, fast forward, that's a part of the brain that has to connect. And so then when you're 18 or 16 and you haven't your brain, that part of your brain that says there's not just one way, there's six different ways. When you get boxed in and you don't have the capacity to know there's options, one way to do is to shoot your way out. And so I really encourage that idea of giving our kids, you know, we're very, again, it goes back to productivity and efficiency. We're very good at structuring dance class, you know, all these classes one after another, and not giving kids time for free play, which is how you exercise that creative muscle. And we now understand how you make important neuro connections that give you more possibilities in life when you get stuck.
I just want to interrupt for a second. So you are talking about neurosynapses in the brain. Their circuitry in our brain actually starts to hook up in early childhood, and that stays with us. Is that what you're saying? That
we need to knit these parts together that are understanding, making those connections between possibilities, that there isn't just one way. There's many ways. You know, there's many ways to put a puzzle together to get to the end result. Like those idea of choices. So, I mean, Susan could tell us how many billions of neuro are we born with that, you know, our whole life it's about making those connections, right?
Yeah, 100 million neurons. And what's also interesting about what Ivy's saying is that, you know, we need to these neural pathways that we create, that another word for it is resilience, right? We build resilience, which means that these pathways are laid down so we understand that if it's not this way, it's that way. It's not one way. And that what happens, you know, when you trigger, the only thing you know is, you know, something happens and I get angry, right? But there's lots of other ways to process emotion than anger. And I think the other thing that we see with a lot of the profiling of people that choose gun violence is that the prefrontal cortex, their rational judgment making has not come online. They're not really building that executive function and that, you know, judgment rationalization, you know, that there are options and there are choices. And art also helps you build executive function. You know, how do I approach this? How do I move through this? And the prefrontal cortex also is where flow, the flow state is. And so, you know, when you move into a flow state, time stands still, right? And it allows you to be able to take a break. And I think that idea of pausing and taking a break and moving into that flow state is also really important, where you're not reacting, you're responding. And so these are all things that the arts do that make your brain healthier. You know, we don't learn about brain health as kids either. We don't learn about the value of the arts. As you said, they're being taken out of schools, or they're being used, if they are in schools, to make you better at math. And that's fine, but that's the tip of the iceberg, right? That's not your core being to build these strong neural pathways that actually make your brain bigger. You know, there's great work around enriched environments, and that when you're in these enriched environments, you build the cerebral cortex, so it gets bigger. And so in this case, bigger is better because you have more capacity to be able to use your brain.
And this is one of the reasons why doctors in London, Canada, they're prescribing patients literally to go to museums, to stand in front of pieces of art that might be even perplexing to you, to see new things, to create those salient experiences that Susan talked about earlier. So because now we know with neuroplasticity, we're constantly making those new connections and we're getting rid of some of the old ones. And so we need to be putting ourselves constantly throughout our age in front of things that we are curious about, new things. We can't just stay doing the same things that we've been doing. That's
things that might surprise us, right?
Yes, constantly, because otherwise we're just digging the existing neural pathways deeper versus, you know, it's like exercising a muscle. Making new neural connections comes from having these new salient experiences. So we have to do that for ourselves throughout the ages.
I want you to talk a little bit about virtual reality and augmented reality. How is this part of the whole arts and environment? What are the good things about it? Because I know that you're immersed in it. And what are the cautions?
Well, you know, it's amazing that the brain, you can put your mind into a different environment. Your mind communicates to your body. So it has the same reaction. There's a program that they're using in hospitals for burn patients where they put them in the environment of, a freezing igloo. And when they remove the bandages, what's usually super painful is no longer painful because the mind feels like it's in a cold environment and it can counteract the pain. So this idea that we can signal to the brain that we're in a different place is incredible asset,
Yes.
And now they're also using light and sound with some VR type hardware to help folks with Alzheimer's. They're finding out that a certain amount of 40 hertz and a certain amount of color will send signals to the brain that will ignite plaque being cleared off the brain. So again, this idea that we can put people in environments to send signals to the brain that aid in the health and well-being, I think is a whole new area that we're just at the, no pun intended, tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, exactly. Wow. There's a one program that I was interested in. This is for stroke victims, and it's called I Am Dolphin.
Yep.
Yeah. That's John Krakauer, and he is a neurologist at Johns Hopkins, and he primarily started this to work with stroke patients because stroke patients get very depressed. They don't like to follow PT because it's really hard, and he wanted to do something that ignited the reward system, that tapped into awe and wonder and got them moving and got them moving in a sort of competitive way, and so video games do that. And so he took some of the learning of the way video games are put together, and he created this dolphin piece of software that allows people to move and move in larger waves of motion that you wouldn't normally do because you're moving as if you're an animal, right? You're moving in lots of different.
So are they acting as if they are the dolphin?
Sometimes, yeah. Or they're just trying.
Or sometimes they move the dolphin.
Yeah, move the dolphin, trying to make the dolphin move and jump, and so when they do that, they get rewards, and there's audio signaling that tells them they've been successful, and so it's quite beautiful. And so what he's found is that it's been very successful for people with stroke, increasing range of motion, and also doing it over longer periods of time. But he's also seeing it being used for creative aging, for people with epilepsy, with other kinds of neurodegenerative or neurological issues. And so he sees it as brain training in a very large way. And so it's really exciting.
Oh, exactly. I'm here with Susan Magselman and Ivy Ross, co-authors of Your Brain on Art. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. I'm here with Susan Magselman and Ivy Ross, and we're talking about the arts and how they help with health. So I want to ask about the personalization of healthcare and our health systems. Are hospitals now tuning into oh, you can try this art project, you can try dancing, or you this or this. Are they using these programs?
Susan, you should also talk about the art pharmacy in this context.
So more and more hospitals and healthcare providers are using the arts, whether that's, if you think of the spectrum of the kinds of professionals that use the arts, sometimes nurses use the arts. People in oncology use it when someone is getting chemotherapy and people find that using their hands helps them to feel calmer. There's different applications.
So they might try knitting while they're doing chemo.
Or embroidery or things like that.
Or embroidery,
I have to interject here. I had a friend who was in the hospital and her doctor literally sat down at her bedside and played the guitar and sang to her. And she believed that that was the thing that made her recover the most. But that's a side note. And that's a doctor happens to sing.
These are the examples I'm really looking for that help us to know how they can be incorporated in our lives. And they really examples of how they affect our lives in very positive ways.
I had a doctor tell me how he sat with a patient and they read poetry together, and it was helped him ease his transition into dying. And he ultimately did die in the hospital. And I think it's showing up in lots of different ways. At the physician level, at the nurse level, there are creative arts therapists that come into hospitals that work bedside medicine. We're seeing music in surgical suites. We're seeing, different ways that these arts experiences are what's called set and setting, getting somebody set to move into something, whether it's surgery or into a therapy. Architects and designers are using neuroaesthetics more for how they're creating spaces. And I think what's important is that it's showing up in micro and macro ways as this field called neuroarts is growing. So this group that I work with called the NeuroArts Blueprint with Aspen and Hopkins, and we have an advisory board that is really an exemplary advisory board that Ivy is also on, is really looking at how do you make this a field? So where do these practitioners train? Where is the research consistently? Who's paying for this? Are healthcare providers paying for that arts therapist to come in? Who's paying for this work to show up in a lobby where artists may be playing music when you come in for the family who's also anxious, right? And also stressed when you have a loved one in a healthcare setting. So that work is happening as a field. But I think the individual agency for people to use this in healthcare on their own is also very valuable.
It occurs to me it's very cost effective. I love that you both are going into research how to train people in this and how to help healthcare providers understand the cost benefit that will be for these programs to be incorporated in their all over healthcare system.
Absolutely. And we look forward to a day where all of this is reimbursable by insurance groups, because it will be not only, it'll be preventative for sure.
And, we've done some work with the NeuroArts Blueprint on economic analyses. And what we see with singing and Alzheimer's is there's a 3-to-1 return on investment. And we're now finishing another economic analysis that will be launched in the next several weeks with AARP and Deloitte, who's done this economic analysis. And it is extraordinary when you think about all of the ways that an art experience like singing with someone with Alzheimer's can have a huge return on investment. So it's very exciting to see not only the scientific evidence, but the economic evidence. And those are the arguments that you need to make in order to really change policy.
So this is going beyond the making a pill to help with Alzheimer's. You're talking about something that is quite effective. I mean, when you say 3-to-1, that's huge. And no pill is doing that, as far as I know. Am I correct in that?
Exactly. And I think what we're seeing now is that the science is aggregating, and we always need more science. Like any field, you always need more evidence. But the economic evidence has really not been brought forth. So people have always seen the arts as a nice to have, not a have to have. And so we medicate people because that's, you know, is been the standard of care. But in fact, when you can bring some of these interventions forward, sometimes you can lower medication, but you also have different effects. So people wake up when you sing with Alzheimer's. They literally wake up. Medication does not wake them up. And sometimes it's as simple as compliance. If you don't have a reason to live, why would you take your medication? But if you're involved in these experiences that give you joy, that make you feel seen, you're more likely to take your medication. So this is not an argument about medication versus no medication. It's part of what does it mean to be a whole person, and how do we use the physiology that we're wired for more effectively, and how do we amplify that? So it's really about collaborating with the medical profession, not, you know, fighting the medical profession.
What can you say about interactive sensory stimulation? I mean, when you put all of those words together, what can you say about that? I know that there is, you mentioned in the book, there's a lab in the New York, I think, Rubin Museum, an exhibition called Mondello Lab, Mandela, and they're using Buddhist principles to support self-awareness and empathy.
So that's a really beautiful example of a kind of way that the arts and aesthetic experiences can help to address something, in this case, mindfulness, right? Mindfulness and meditation. And that ties into, you know, a sense of well-being and calm in your body. And so what they did was create these experiences where would help you move into a deeper state of mindfulness. And one of the things they did was help you understand your sensory systems. So they opened you up to scent and to touch and to sound. And I think that was really important because I think we all walk in kind of in this flat line. And so that was the first thing that they did. Another thing that they did that I thought was really beautiful is they had a big vessel that had different tonal drums, and you were able to see how vibration works at different tonal levels, and, you know, extrapolating that into how your body absorbs different sound waves. So, you know, these lower sound waves vibrate, they're much bigger, the higher pitch ones are much closer together. And you got to sort of understand the sense of sound and vibration.
And would you feel your body, how your body reacted to all those sounds, and which ones you said, oh, I love this one, this one felt so good. And so you start to understand
and experience, right? Practice, practice, practice. I talk about this a lot. It's really important that you have the experience, not just talk about the experience.
I just want to mention, I said this in the opening thoughts of opening the program, that 20 minutes of doodling or humming a day is hey, that's a good thing. So say something about how just doodling or humming is a good thing.
Well, doodling, what's great is, you know, we've all done it in school and we've gotten the dirty looks from the teachers, or in meetings and you get a dirty look from your boss. But now we know that when you're doodling, it's igniting the part of your brain that activates memory. So you're actually remembering what your teacher or your boss is saying better by doodling. And, you know, what we hope is that, just like it took many years of scientists drilling into us how important 20 minutes of exercise a day is, or 8 hours of sleep. And so we believe that we will be a success if the world starts to practice 20 minutes of art, either making or receiving a day, as a, you know, a preventative measure as well, just like sleep and exercises.
And intention, with intention. You know, often listen to music in the car, but what if you know you're singing in the car because you're, you know, activating your parasympathetic nervous system and you're making yourself feel more, less stressed. So this awareness, or you're cooking and you're not just sort of throwing stuff together, but you're sitting to taste what you're actually eating, right? You know, and thinking about things like humming in the shower, what's that first cup of coffee, this intentional way that we create that sacredness around these experiences make our days very different, very intentional. And I think that's a big part of the power of the arts and aesthetic experience.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Well, you've given us a lot to ingest here and to really feel the possibilities in our life and what it is to participate in art or observe art and bring that more consciously into our lives. I've been speaking with Susan Maxelman and Ivy Ross. I want to spell Susan's name, Maxelman, M-A-G-S-A-M-E-N, Maxelman and Ivy Ross. They are the co-authors of Your Brain on Art, How the Arts Transform Us. And if you want to know more about their work, you can go to their website, yourbrainonart.com, or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You've been listening to New Dimensions. This is program number 3829. This is program number 3829.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. For over four decades, New Dimensions has been producing weekly conversations at the leading edge. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org, or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore New Dimensions. New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support, and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Brenda Peterson, author of I Want to Be Left Behind, Finding Rapture Here on Earth. Next time...
This is Free Voices at CJSF 90.1 FM, talking to you about
Eagle Nation Universal Production Society. We are 10 board of directors and we are rejoicing for world history. Our show is based on true stories, musical and storytelling and role-playing, silent crimes broken, very interesting series of show.
And a lot of in-depth oral tradition. We play every Thursday from 3 to 4. Come and join us.